is knowing. Crow!
All right, now, welcome to Crow 777 Radio. This is hour one of episode 641. This is actually part three of a three-part run we've done on the intelligence agencies, just me and Jason. The reason we did this is because there's nary a show we have covered that probably doesn't tie into this one way or another. Probably not the health stuff so much. But, I mean, wouldn't you say, Jason, 80% of our shows probably touch on this?
Yeah, easily.
And it's because of the influence, and it's become so laissez-faire. Here's an example. The CIA is not supposed to operate within the U.S., and I did a quick lookup, and at the top of Wikipedia, it says they're not supposed to, but they've been caught doing it, and there were some concerns that the Constitution might have been violated. This is kind of, you know, the level of laissez-faire that this has gotten to, and yet they're behind so much. But what do? They gather intelligence. And think about what that means. If we went back to the 1970s, consider what intelligence or information gathering would have been then compared to now. Now it's nonstop everywhere, nothing but it goes so much deeper. As an example, it is known now that Bob Dylan was a wartime Pentagon agent. One of the examples that's starting to emerge, everyone remember Che Guevara? He used to be on t-shirts everywhere. When he was being tracked, one of the intel guys was Al Baez doing that. That's the father of Joan Baez in military intel and claimed to be Dylan's controller. The old tricks are the best tricks. People like Ice Cube had noted that the entire genre of rapper hip hop was designed as a psychological operation. To brainwash, to hold people in low states of vibration. And what's worse, there are claims now that the very same people that own the rap game own the corporate-controlled prison game. That's a terrible, terrible thing. And it's been used as a low-frequency device, which Jason and I have covered. To put it in a nutshell, the intel agencies easily eclipse Edward Bernays. And Jason and I have both said we can't think of another thing we've covered that changed culture more than Edward Bernays. And lastly, have people forgotten what was the first chips we saw called? They were called Intel. And they weren't lying. Remember the moniker Intel Inside. But anyhow, I just wanted to frame it up, Jason, because I think people sometimes forget just how woven into our world the Intel agencies are.
Yeah, well, I don't think we can get away from that. All you got to do is look at the music in the 1960s and all the ties there, and that'll tell you all you need to know.
Yeah, and we're going to be doing another music episode shortly. We may do some tie-ins. But just the Intel thing alone kind of underscores what my view is, that we got the digital world for the simply planned world takeover. The digital world, in my mind, is wholly about control. And as it has shaken out, think about the control of all the devices we use, even if we set aside the chip called Intel Inside. But anyhow, there it is. You want to add anything or shall we jump in?
Let's get in here. We're picking up in the 1970s. On December 22nd, 1974, the journalist Seymour Hersh publishes a New York Times article that exposes the CIA's domestic surveillance program that was known as Operation Chaos, which aimed to monitor anti-war activists as well as other Americans. The article was based on leaks from CIA insiders and alleges violations of the CIA's charter that prohibits domestic activities. This sparks public as well as congressional outrage and set the stage for what came to be known as the Church Committee. On December 27, 1975, the U.S. Senate establishes the Select Committee to Study Governmental Operations with Respect to Intelligence Agencies by a vote of 82-4. Senator Frank Church is appointed as the chairman. The committee includes 11 senators from both political parties who are tasked with investigating the reality of intelligence agency abuses. In February and March of 1975, the committee begins gathering evidence, requesting documents from the CIA, FBI, NSA, and other agencies. The CIA's Family Jewels Report, which was a 1973 internal document listing agency misdeeds, which included such things as the 1963 Project Mockingbird wiretapping of journalists is provided to the committee, albeit under pressure, though it is heavily redacted. In April of 1975, the committee holds closed-door hearings to review classified materials. Early testimony that comes from CIA officials, which would include Director William Colby, reveals the agency's infiltration of domestic groups and media. The committee learns of CIA ties to approximately 50 U.S. journalists and media outlets, which would later be linked to allegations of Operation Mockingbird.
The level of damnation that this one paragraph is putting out on the table, how does it ever get overlooked? It's showing you that the supposed Fourth Estate, or whatever they called it, the newspapers at the time, had been compromised. But what's worse to me is they are constantly making fun of us. What was it called? Operation Chaos. Most people listening are probably not old enough to remember Get Smart back on primetime TV. The villain in Get Smart was Chaos. It never ends.
In May and June of 1975, public hearings begin, which focus on high-profile issues like the CIA's assassination plots against foreign leaders, such as Fidel Castro and Patrice Lumumba. These revelations, that are detailed in closed sessions and would later be publicized, overshadow media-related findings, but fuel scrutiny of CIA overreach. In July of 1975, the committee investigates the CIA's domestic activities, including the 1963 Project Mockingbird, stated as the wiretapping of journalists Robert Allen and Paul Scott to trace leaks. This is distinct from the broader Operation Mockingbird allegations, but highlights CIA media surveillance. Testimony confirms the CIA maintained covert relationships with journalists to influence reporting, though no formal program named Operation Mockingbird is documented in declassified records. In August and September 1975, the committee expands its probe into FBI abuses under COINTELPRO, which targeted civil rights leaders like Martin Luther King Jr. and NSA's Project Shamrock, which intercepted Americans' communications. These findings parallel concerns about CIA media manipulation, as all involve violations of civil liberties. In October of 1975, public hearings intensify with testimony from former CIA officers and journalists. The committee uncovers evidence of CIA funding to media outlets and front organizations, corroborating parts of the Operation Mockingbird allegations. However, specifics such as names of journalists remain classified to protect sources. On April 26, 1976, the Church Committee releases its final report, which spans six volumes, titled Final Report of the Select Committee to Study Governmental Operations with Respect to Intelligence Activities. Key findings that are relevant to Operation Mockingbird include the CIA maintained covert relationships with about 50 American journalists or media organizations from the 1950s to the 1970s and used them to gather intelligence and influence public opinion. These relationships included paid arrangements, though the report notes that many journalists were unaware of CIA involvement. The 1963 Project Mockingbird wiretapping is cited as an example of illegal domestic surveillance, though it's treated as a separate operation. The report criticizes the CIA's violation of its charter, which prohibits domestic operations, but does not use the term Operation Mockingbird explicitly.
So, I mean, does some of this reach treason? It certainly violates the Constitution. It certainly violates the fact that they're not supposed to operate within our borders. And back then, the papers were a big deal. That's basically taking control and programming people through news and media. So it looks to me, Jason, like when Eisenhower came out and said, you guys better watch out, maybe what he should have been saying is, you guys are already screwed. Pardon my French. But by the 60s and 70s, was this whole blackmail thing of people in power already in full swing? Why was nothing ever done? Why is this documented and put out to the public And not a single thing is done, as far as I can tell, to change any of it.
In April and May of 1976, the committee recommends reforms, including stronger congressional oversight of intelligence agencies and restrictions on domestic activities. It leads to the creation of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence in 1976 and the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA, in 1978. In June of 1976, the committee's work concludes, having held 126 public and closed hearings, interviewed over 800 witnesses, and reviewed 110,000 pages of documents. Its findings on media infiltration gain less public attention than assassination plots, but the findings will fuel later investigations like Carl Bernstein's 1977 Rolling Stone article on CIA media ties. And in 1977, Carl Bernstein's article, The CIA and the Media, does build on Church Committee findings, alleging over 400 journalists and major outlets such as CBS and the New York Times collaborated with the CIA under Operation Mockingbird. The article popularizes the term, but seems to lack the primary evidence that the committee had access to, leading to debate over its claims. In 1979, Deborah Davis publishes her book Catherine the Great, which further publicizes Operation Mockingbird and alleges deep CIA ties to the Washington Post. Historians like David P. Hadley later critique such claims for lacking declassified evidence, noting that the Church Committee provided the most authoritative data. From the 1980s until today, the Church Committee's revelations have led to ongoing skepticism about government media relations. While the committee confirmed CIA media ties, the full scope of Operation Mockingbird remains debated due to limited declassification. The 1963 Project Mockingbird wiretapping, however, was absolutely a real thing and is fully documented in the Family Jewels report.
It looks to me like they put on a show, Jason. It looks to me like the people reporting like Bernstein were either directed or just inside the game. That's what it looks like to me. It's ridiculous to consider the things that are being outed, the way it's treated, even to this day, going to Wikipedia and looking up what I told you when I opened. You know, it may violate the Constitution. There was a time in this country when that was a very big deal. And to put a fine point on it, if I had to ask you, Jason, at what point we lost our privacy, could you even answer that?
No, honestly, no. But it's going to be way earlier than most people think.
I always point to the Sun Microsystems guy right at the turn of the new millennium saying, guess what? You got all these cool tools, but you've got no privacy. No one believed him, but it was true. So how long had this even been going on? And there was a time in the 60s and 70s, if someone wanted to know what was on your library card, for crying out loud, there would have been hell to pay. So in the same way that we're looking all these shows and these committees put together and not a whole hell of a lot of anything done about it, over this time, we have absolutely lost every single shred of privacy we ever had, whether it was medical, whether it's our movements, anything, everything. It's all being collected, and no one can really put their finger on when it happened.
Operation Mockingbird and related subjects were not the only things uncovered during the Church Committee hearings. From 1967 and into the 1970s, the NSA had Operation Minaret, which was a companion to Project Shamrock, whose goal was to target specific Americans, including civil rights leaders and anti-war activists, such as Jane Fonda and Muhammad Ali, by monitoring their communications without judicial oversight. The Church Committee does expose Minaret, highlighting its violation of Fourth Amendment protections. In the 1960s and 1970s, the CIA mail opening program, HTLINGUAL, was also demonstrated to exist. The CIA had been illegally opening and reading over 215,000 pieces of domestic and international mail in cities like New York and San Francisco, targeting dissidents and ordinary citizens. It was said to have begun in 1953, and the program is exposed by the Church Committee, confirming violations of privacy laws. But we aren't done yet. From 1970 until 1973, the Houston Plan, by the FBI, CIA, and NSA, that was proposed by White House aide Tom Charles Houston was a plan to authorize intelligence agencies to conduct widespread surveillance, including break-ins, wiretapping, and mail opening against anti-war and leftist groups. It was officially rejected by President Richard M. Nixon, but elements had been implemented covertly until being exposed by the Church Committee. And to finish off, from 1972 until 1974, there's the Watergate break-in and aftermath involving the CIA and the FBI. Both agencies are implicated in supporting the Nixon administration's illegal activities, which included the break-in at the Democratic National Committee headquarters and wiretapping of political adversaries. The scandal, while considered primarily a White House operation, reveals intelligence agency complicity.
Well, my last question, when did we lose our privacy due to the research you laid down in that paragraph? We know it was gone by the 50s, right? They're opening mail with impunity. And Watergate, for those of us who were alive back then, it can't even be stated how big a deal it was. It went on and on and on. Back in those days, we had evening news for a short period of time before the prime time or family hour. And it was just wall to wall with this. It went on and on and on. I can't even tell you how long it went on. But isn't it interesting, Jason, at the top of this, you're naming their projects Minaret, and then you name Ali. So it sounds like it had to do with Muslims. And the other one, Shamrock. So was there some Irish connection? But at this point, we can safely conclude that our privacy was gone by the 1950s, according to the church information. So there's that.
During World War I is probably when a lot of it went out the window, because there was even the initial Red Scare that took place in the very early 20th century where they were making lists and all that kind of stuff.
I'm with you. I wonder if there were any decades at all that resembled this free country, America, what we were told in the history that gets reiterated all the time. I wonder if there was ever a significant period of time where it resembled what we were being told.
The 1980s would begin seeing the Cold War at a fever pitch as U.S.-Soviet relations deteriorated following the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in 1979 and Ronald Reagan's election in 1980, which ushered in an aggressive anti-communist stance. Intelligence agencies played central roles in proxy conflicts, most notably the CIA's Operation Cyclone, which ran from 1979 until 1989, which funneled billions of dollars in arms and training to Afghan Mujahideen fighting Soviet forces. Directed by CIA Director William Casey, this covert operation, coordinated with Pakistan's ISI and Saudi intelligence, supplied Stinger missiles that crippled Soviet air superiority, contributing to the USSR's withdrawal by 1989. The KGB, meanwhile, countered with espionage and disinformation in Afghanistan, targeting Western-backed fighters, but struggled to maintain control amid domestic economic strain. Espionage scandals and counterintelligence operations defined the 1980s, exposing vulnerabilities in Western and Soviet systems. The 1985 Year of the Spy saw multiple high-profile cases. U.S. Navy officer John Walker was arrested for selling secrets to the KGB for nearly two decades, compromising naval codes, while CIA officer Aldrich Ames began spying for the Soviets, betraying dozens of agents. The KGB's penetration of Western agencies echoed the 1970s Kim Philby affair, but was countered by significant defections, such as the previously mentioned KGB Colonel Oleg Gordievsky, who provided MI6 with critical intelligence on Soviet strategies until his 1985 escape. MI6 and the CIA also exploited Soviet technological weaknesses by intercepting communications through operations like the Farewell Dossier, where French intelligence, via Soviet defector Vladimir Vetrov, exposed KGB technology theft in 1981 and 1982, enabling the U.S. to sabotage Soviet infrastructure. The rise of terrorism and cyber intelligence emerged as new frontiers, which began reshaping agency priorities. The 1983 Beirut barracks bombing and increasing Middle Eastern terrorism prompted the CIA and Israel's Mossad to expand counterterrorism units, a departure from the Cold War focus of earlier decades.
I mean, all the world is a stage, and this really underscores it. I can remember back when the Russians were in Afghanistan, and not too long after that, you're going to start getting the Rocky movies and all the other things, and the Hind helicopter that was so famous that they supposedly blew out of the air with weapons they gave. But we switched places later with Russia, right? We made fun of they couldn't possibly win that Asian war. Who would go in and do such a thing? And then we switched places with them. And everybody knows how we left Afghanistan. But there are certain things in here, like all the espionage. When you're in the Marine Corps, you hear about all this big time. And the Beirut bombing, that is a massive deal in the Marine Corps. I mean, I can't even overstate what a big deal that whole thing is.
Amid the heightened Cold War tensions under President Ronald Reagan, the FBI intensified counterintelligence efforts against Soviet espionage. Libraries, particularly those that contained scientific and technical collections, were seen as potential targets for foreign agents seeking unclassified but sensitive information. And so, between 1980 and 1985, the FBI begins the Library Awareness Program, initially in New York City, targeting major research libraries like those at Columbia University and the New York Public Library. The exact start date is unclear, as the program was clandestine and not formally documented until its exposure. The FBI's rationale for the program was to identify Soviet or Eastern Bloc agents using open source materials to gather technical data for military or industrial purposes. From 1985 until 1987, FBI agents approached librarians, asking them to monitor patrons' reading habits and report individuals requesting materials on sensitive topics such as computer science, engineering, or nuclear technology. The FBI particularly focused on patrons with foreign-sounding names, accents, or those perceived as Eastern or Soviet-affiliated. Agents conducted in-person visits to libraries, sometimes presenting themselves as part of a national security effort, where they requested access to circulation records, interlibrary loan requests, and database search histories, without judicial warrants. In some cases, they asked librarians to report suspicious behavior, such as frequent use of microfilm or requests for obscure technical journals. The program primarily operated in New York, but did extend to other cities with major research institutions, which included Boston and Washington, D.C. The FBI targeted academic and public libraries with significant STEM collections, as well as corporate libraries. Many librarians, who were trained in protecting patron privacy, resisted FBI requests, citing ethical and legal concerns. The American Library Association emphasized confidentiality as a core principle, which created tension with the FBI. The program is exposed in September of 1987 when Paula Kaufman, a librarian at Columbia University, alerts the media after repeated FBI visits. The New York Times publishes an article on September 18, 1987, detailing the FBI's efforts to monitor library patrons, which sparked public and academic outrage. Reports confirm the FBI had approached dozens of libraries, with estimates of 20 to 50 institutions that were contacted in New York alone. The program's lack of legal oversight, meaning no warrants or subpoenas were used, raised comparisons to earlier FBI abuses like COINTELPRO. FBI Director William S. Sessions, of course, defends the program, claiming it was essential to counter Soviet espionage. He argued that libraries were open sources that were vulnerable to foreign agents, and that the program was voluntary, not coercive. However, librarians had reported feeling pressured by FBI agents.
This is all poppycock. This is all drivel. I have members of my family who work at libraries. It got so bad. And by the way, the idea that there were 20 to 50 institutions, it was everywhere. the librarians were defending themselves from this onslaught and actually hanging signs in libraries for the public to see that said, it's been so many days since the FBI has tried to access your records and things like this. Then they got pressured for doing that. And what's worst of all in this drivel is that it's voluntary or open source and that foreigners can get. No, foreigners don't have access to your library records. And what's worst of all is if you go back a few decades, there were actually big public fights about keeping our library cards and what we checked out private. But then, of course, you get movies like the Mel Gibson movie, where that's exactly what they're doing. They're tagging books. So when a book gets bought, they get flagged and, you know, their whole thing. People have seen the movie. But I would also ask, based on what Jason laid down here, how many invasions or wars have been started just so they can get access to antiquities, museums, databases, or all that kind of stuff? I mean, recently, Jason, it seems like much of what we've seen in the Middle East, like protect this museum, and then the next day you hear the museum was robbed.
I think there's a lot of that going on in both Gulf Wars.
As a matter of fact, I think they just tried to defame what happened in some of those museums by putting out the ridiculous Hillary Clinton wants to know where the Nephilim thing is. But how is it that the oldest antiquities in the world go over the news that, oh, we're protecting that, and a day later, everything's been robbed? They're basically doing whatever they want. And I think it's pretty clear at this point that they have control, whether it's through blackmail or whatever the case may be. It seems to be its own power structure, its own, for lack of better terms, government that is answerable to nobody.
On November 9th, 1989, we see the fall of the Berlin Wall, which had been erected in 1961 to divide East and West Berlin and had been a symbol of the Iron Curtain's ideological divide. This marked a pivotal moment in the decline of Soviet influence, signaling the unraveling of the Eastern Bloc, which weakened the Soviet Union's global position. This event, which had been driven by internal dissent, economic stagnation, and Western pressures, had profound implications for the KGB, the Soviet Union's formidable intelligence agency, which struggled to maintain control amid rapid political change. By 1991, following the Soviet Union's collapse, the KGB was dismantled, with its functions split into the SVR for foreign intelligence and the FSB for domestic security in the newly formed Russian Federation. This translation reflected a broader shift in global intelligence dynamics, moving from Cold War bipolarity to a more fragmented world.
I may be off base here, but this is the way that I suspect it happened. The story that we're told about the Berlin Wall coming down, and we'll set aside all the famous people showing up, is that there was a miscommunication of some kind. Go look at what they claim happened. It makes no sense. If this weakened the Russians, then why didn't they simply just keep defending it as they always had? Nothing would have changed. So it looks to me like some higher power flipped the switch on this. That's what it feels like to me. I mean, what do you think, Jason? Do you buy there was a miscommunication and some guy actually said the wrong thing on air and that's how all this happened?
Oh, I thought David Hasselhoff saved us.
There you go. That's probably much closer to acceptable.
Yeah, I don't know. That story was always like, seriously, that's what happened?
I mean, in a real world situation where people are guarding things, you get orders from above. Some guy accidentally saying something on the, it just, none of it makes sense. I suspect that the true government behind all this flipped the switch and decided it was time for that to open.
Well, there is a reality to the Soviet Union struggling financially. They had economic problems for many years. And I think it's pretty obvious that communism does not work.
Yeah, but ironically, we seem to be creeping into a technical version of communism right now.
In the 1990s, intelligence agencies worldwide had to undergo a significant pivot, shifting their focus from Cold War superpower rivalries to emerging threats like terrorism, nuclear proliferation, and cyber threats, driven by the collapse of the Soviet Union and the rise of a unipolar world dominated by the United States. The dissolution of the USSR in 1991, following the 1989 fall of the Berlin Wall, dismantled the bipolar framework that had defined espionage, forcing agencies like the CIA, MI6, Russia's SVR, and others to adapt to a fragmented geopolitical landscape. This decade would see the rise of non-state actors, rogue states, and digital technologies, reshaping intelligence priorities and methods. Intelligence agencies responded with significant operational changes, prioritizing counterterrorism and proliferation. The CIA had established its Counterterrorism Center, CTC, in 1986, but it expanded in the 1990s to track groups like Al-Qaeda, which means the base, which had been founded by Osama bin Laden in 1988. Operations targeted terrorist financing and training camps, with early efforts to capture bin Laden following the 1998 U.S. embassy bombings in Kenya and Tanzania. MI6 and France's DGSE similarly shifted resources to monitor jihadist networks in the Middle East and North Africa, while Israel's Mossad intensified its focus on Palestinian terrorism and Iran's nuclear ambitions. To counter proliferation, the CIA and Germany's BND infiltrated Iraq's WMD programs, though flawed assessments are said to later contribute to the 2003 Iraq War. Russia's SVR, weakened by post-Soviet turmoil, focused on economic espionage and monitoring NATO expansion, while the FSB tackled Chechen separatism, which was a form of domestic terrorism. The impact of the 1990s pivot redefined intelligence for a post-Cold War era. Counterterrorism efforts disrupted numerous plots, such as the CIA's foiling of a 1995 Al-Qaeda plan to bomb U.S. airliners, while proliferation intelligence shaped sanctions against Iraq and North Korea. Cyber capabilities laid the groundwork for modern digital espionage, though agencies' slow adaptation is said to have contributed to the 2001 9/11 attacks.
How ironic is it? When you have a big attack, you need more intel, you need more infrastructure. So look what happened here. 1995, oh, we're doing our job. We stopped an airliner that they wanted to do something bad with. 2001, see, we told you, they got one through. Look what happens. But if you back up and look at this whole thing, we've covered so many times that there's basically three city-states controlling the world, right? The U.S. is the muscle. The bankers over in the city of London are the money, and the Vatican takes the religious platform. I don't notice any of those in Russia. At what level are decisions being made here? But you see the fingerprints everywhere. Counterterrorism Center is CTC. There's your 33. And if you want to mention Osama bin Laden, that's an actor for my money. Recall how he was brought down and instantly thrown in the ocean so no one could see what was going on. All the world is truly a stage, and this is where the orders come from, almost certainly, or at least a lot of them.
The FBI had two high-profile cases that ended in the deaths of multiple American citizens in the 1990s. The first is the Ruby Ridge incident, which occurred in August of 1992 in northern Idaho. It was a deadly standoff between federal law enforcement, which consisted of agents from the FBI and U.S. Marshals Service, against the family of Randy Weaver, who was called a white separatist. The confrontation resulted in the deaths of a U.S. Marshal, along with Weaver's wife and son, which exposed significant FBI mismanagement, as well as excessive use of force, with subsequent cover-up attempts. The second is the Waco siege, which lasted from February 28th to April 19th, 1993, and was a 51-day standoff between federal law enforcement that consisted primarily of agents from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, along with the FBI, pitted against the Branch Davidian religious sect, said to be a splinter from the Seventh-day Adventist Church, which was led by the rather charismatic but apparently unhinged and dangerous David Koresh, at their compound near Waco, Texas. The confrontation was sparked by an ATF raid to investigate illegal firearms and escalated into one of the deadliest federal law enforcement operations in U.S. history. It resulted in 82 deaths, which included 76 Branch Davidians, 25 of which were children, along with four ATF agents. This tragic incident exposed significant missteps by the ATF and FBI, which included poor intelligence, excessive force, and questionable decision-making. These are, sadly, only two examples of extreme measures that have been taken against American citizens. A similar fate would be leveled against talk show host Bill Cooper on November 5th, 2001, who had often spoken about these two cases.
And is this how people actually react in the world, I would ask? There's so many things we could say about this. But one of the big things that came on the tail of it was, were those military assets in there? Military is not supposed to operate in the borders. But I'm going to sum up this whole thing by saying this. The first time you see something like this, it is shocking. And every time afterwards, less so and less so. It's almost like the frog in boiling water. And while I could say many, many other things about this, this is 1990 and we are in the slow free fall towards 2001, and it is gaining and gaining and gaining momentum. The first time you see a thing, it's shocking. After that, it gets less so until it's normal. I mean, is that a safe way to put it, Jason?
Well, I remember when this was going on, and I always felt like what they were doing seemed above and beyond any rational behavior that should be occurring on American soil. Like, it just seemed like there was never enough information being given to us in the public to warrant what the hell they were doing.
Absolutely. And so much of it was on film. Absolutely. Do people actually act like that in real life? I mean, wasn't there somebody with a little common sense on the ground that might say, hey, man, there's young people in there? It gets to the point where you're wondering, is everything staged everywhere when you see this level of what is going on here? And that's how all this goes. It creates confusion, anger, and everything else that goes with it, but it deteriorates how we view ourselves. At this point, I wonder if we even have a semi-normal view of what a human being is, because in my lifetime, everything that's been put in front of me, or much of it, has been designed to show me that human beings are untrustable, they're violent, and we are at war nonstop with everyone everywhere.
In 1994, France's DGSE, the country's external intelligence agency, was actively adapting to the challenges of a post-colonial world and the rising threat of terrorism, building on its predecessor, the SDECE, established in 1946. Operating under the Ministry of Defense, the DGSE navigated a complex global landscape which was marked by the end of the Cold War, France's diminishing colonial influence, and the emergence of jihadist networks, particularly in North Africa and the Middle East. The 1991 Gulf War highlighted the dangers of rogue states such as Iraq, while the Algerian Civil War, which lasted from 1991 until 2002, pitted the government against Islamist groups like the Armed Islamic Group, which posed direct risks to French security due to colonial ties and a large Algerian diaspora. The DGSE reorganized from the SDECE in 1982 to modernize operations, was tasked with countering terrorism, monitoring proliferation, and stabilizing France's influence in Africa and the Middle East. Unlike the 1990s pivot of agencies like the CIA, which broadly targeted terrorism post-Cold War, the DGSE's adaptation was deeply tied to France's post-colonial responsibilities, addressing unrest in former territories while aligning with Western allies. The DGSE's adaptation in 1994 had a significant impact, strengthening France's ability to counter terrorism and maintain influence in a post-colonial world. Its intelligence on Algerian jihadists helped prevent attacks on French soil, while its African operations preserved France's strategic presence, though failures in Rwanda exposed limits in crisis response. The agency's integration into NATO frameworks enhanced France's role in Western intelligence, sharing data on Middle Eastern threats.
I mean, besides the fact that SDECE seems to be a nod to the 9/11 idea, at some point, you've got to recognize with common sense that they're just saying words. they're just saying meaningless things as the foundation of what they want to do. Like this, in 1991, the Gulf highlighted the dangers of rogue states such as Iraq. Has anyone ever felt threatened by Iraq? If you compare what everybody did over there, who do you really need to be worried about? And they're just saying things. And in this case, there's no basis for it. And that was proven in news coast to coast in this country. Remember the WMDs, Colin Powell being propped up and forced to say things that were patently proven false? It never ends. Common sense has been left in the rear view. And at this point, I don't know when we get it back, because everything we see, there's no there. It's just words.
In 1998, the nuclear tests conducted by India and Pakistan, India's Pokhran 2 tests on May 11th and 13th, and Pakistan's Chagai 1 and 2 tests on May 28th and 30th, marked a dramatic escalation in the rivalry between India's Research and Analysis Wing and Pakistan's Inter-Services Intelligence. These tests, which formalized both nations as being a nuclear power, heightened tensions over long-standing issues like Kashmir, mutual suspicions of internal interference, and nuclear arms competition, intensifying the covert operations of RAW and ISI, both agencies, which were already entrenched in a decades-long shadow war, ramped up espionage, counterintelligence, and proxy activities, leveraging their respective strengths to assert dominance in a newly nuclearized South Asia. The intensified RAW-ISI rivalry had significant repercussions, shaping South Asia's security landscape and global non-proliferation efforts. The nuclear tests, which had been condemned by the UN Security Council via Resolution 1172, led to U.S. sanctions under the Glenn Amendment, isolating both nations economically and diplomatically. RAW's intelligence informed India's diplomatic push to normalize relations with the U.S., as seen in the 1998-1999 Strobe-Talbot-Jaswant-Singh talks, while the ISI's actions fueled Pakistan's internal pariah status, particularly after Kargil. Both agencies' failures to detect the tests highlighted intelligence gaps, prompting internal reforms, such as RAW's integration of technical intelligence via the 2004 National Technical Research Organization. RAW and ISI's 1998 operations were driven by mutual distrust and nuclear brinkmanship. Kashmir was considered a flashpoint, as noted in declassified U.S. reports that warned of a 1-in-5 chance of conflict. Now, isn't that something we still hear about to this day?
As far back as I can remember, yeah, it goes on and on. But this is my point. There's no there. They're just saying words. If what I have put forward is correct, that nuclear weapons do not exist as described, if that statement from me is correct, this is just words. There is absolutely, it's just like going to a play where someone made up a fictitious story and everyone sat there and watched it and nod their head. So, I mean, this is where we are at in the world. And to me, this is unsustainable. To me, this is what the new era coming in is about. We're rising in vibration, consciousness, and all the things that go with it. Slowly but surely, things like this will just simply become unacceptable, unable to resonate at their low frequency and the higher frequency reality that is emerging. That's my point of view. So I'll ask you point blank, Jason, am I off base? Am I out of my mind? Am I basing everything I just said on something that is completely unacceptable? Nuclear weapons do not exist as described.
I would say it'd be very difficult to document nuclear weapons overall not existing, but we have seen scientific proof that absolutely challenges the atomic narrative from the World War II era.
We have, and we've also seen every effort made to outlaw and label as dangerous the supposed components like plutonium or uranium that make them. And I am also of a mind, or maybe I should safely say, I suspect that in the eras of alchemy, those elements were critically, critically important. And let's not forget old Galen Windsor, who sat up there and did shots of those elements.
So that's going to do it for hour one. When we come back for hour two, we're going to pick up with the events of 9/11.
And here we are. The world changes on 9/11, and everyone here is probably old enough to remember that, and it's never going to be the same as it once was, but the new era is emerging. So that's going to be hour one of episode 641, the third part of the intelligence agency's run, which is one of the biggest deals there is to talk about, I would imagine. Hour one is free to everybody at crow777radio.com. Members know to log in for the full episode. Members get access to all the forums and comments sections. They can create top-level ideas and post them where they can get talked about. They can stream the two-hour film called Shoot the Moon anytime they like. It has 10 awards in the world, the last two from India, and it covers all my prior telescope work to include lunar waves, UFOs, and the discovery of the so-called second sun. Also available on the site, I'm working on my 18th member-only solar video. Members get exclusive access to my solar work now because I do not post my work on censorship platforms. Also, the still images are available there. With that, we're going to wrap up, take a short break on hour one, and come back and do hour two. I would like to wish you all a happy, healthy, and higher-minded new era. There it is, man. Cheers.
Belief is the enemy of knowing.